Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Friday, April 1st, 2016. It is 1:06 p.m. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this afternoon, Co-Chairman Kelly.
Good afternoon.
Senator Hoffman.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good afternoon.
Senator Bishop.
Good afternoon.
And we should be joined shortly by Senator Machicki and Senator Olson. On the schedule this afternoon is Senate Bill 91, the Omnibus Crime Bill, Laws, Procedures, and Corrections. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? We are having two folks who we've invited to speak that are calling in, one that needs to catch a plane, and then we'll go to public testimony on SB 91, 2 minutes per individual, and I'll be going around the state based on the call-in times.
Is there
any
specific section?
No. If there are those online and off-net, if you have specific revisions or comments on a particular portion of the bill, we have the CS for the sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 91 Judiciary. It's the version backslash S, and so we have a committee member, Senator Dunleavy, who requested that you identify a page number and section. If you have specific public comment on a portion of the bill, it will help us identify where you're speaking to. Check one more time. Ms. Ann Seymour, National Crime Victim Advocate. Ann, are you there?
I am, Chairwoman McKinnon.
Welcome to Senate Finance. We can. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you so much.
If you could provide some comments, there was some conversation over the past few days on the notion of jail time versus limiting jail time or continuing to incarcerate specifically victims of sexual violence, or not the victims, but the perpetrators of sexual violence, to incarcerate them for longer periods of time of parole and otherwise. And we were looking for a victim's rights advocate that had a perspective that we may not have heard from yet.
I was asked to give a little bit of history about how victims were engaged in the justice reinvestment and justice reform process. That was my guidance in this conversation.
Thank you. Please provide your comments.
Okay. But I'd be happy to do a little research and get back to you on your other question. That's not an issue at all for me. I want to thank you, Chairwoman McKinnon and Chairman Kelly and members of the committee for the opportunity to talk about SB 91. And you have my written testimony, so I'm going to summarize it. My role in justice reform in Alaska was to facilitate the outreach to crime victims and survivors and victim service professionals last year in the early stages of the commission reform initiative, and that's what I want to talk about briefly today. You can read my credentials. Basically said I've been a national crime victim advocate for 33 years, and I've worked in all 50 states for a long time on promoting victims' rights and services. Had the opportunity for about a decade to serve on the D.C. Sentencing Commission, and I've been really fortunate to do quite a bit of work in Alaska, starting with being the national liaison when y'all were working to pass your victims' constitutional amendment. And then I did work in the 90s on training and technical assistance that helped create your Department of Corrections victim program, and also worked on sex offender management and policy to try to make sure that those efforts were victim-centered. And I give you that background as a way of just saying that I'm pretty deep in the weeds in terms of criminal justice and corrections reforms. And my involvement is always simply to assure that victims' voices are heard and that when we speak about public safety, we also consider the individual safety of victims and survivors and members of our community. And I recall with a lot of frustration when I was a young victim advocate, victims had virtually no rights. They were an afterthought if they were thought about at all. And I always quote Mel Myers, a colleague and friend in Texas whose daughter was murdered. Mel said just about the only right a victim of crime has is to be present at the commission of the crime. And while that was a few decades ago, I remember watching from the sidelines as justice reform efforts passed in state after state with little or no considerations of victims' concerns. And if I was to be really honest with you, I would let you know that I did sort of lead the national fight to lengthen prison terms for violent offenders and to build more prisons, because I really felt like victims were being ignored and they had very few rights and they were not being listened to. And so for me to say today, times have changed, this is a real understatement. I think the most significant change, and very specific to Alaska, is that today when we talk about justice reform, we strongly involve victims and survivors and those who serve them in the overall reform process. And I've worked in justice reform in almost 20 states in the past 5 years, and every single state is unique. I know folks in Alaska can certainly appreciate that. But what's happened in the states is that there have been significant reinvestments into victim services. South Dakota has built an amazing victim notification program. In Pennsylvania, they focused on providing victim advocates for victims of juvenile offenders. Hawaii's reinvestment really focused on restitution management. And in Oregon, they actually doubled the amount of funds that went into state domestic and sexual violence service funds, among other provisions. And so while each state is very different in how they do their reinvestment, there is a consistency among states that show that simply and states have reduced their prison population and also at the same time, really important, reduced their crime rates. And I lead you to the first two states I worked in. In 2010, South Carolina reduced its prison population by 20%, and at the same time, they've seen a reduction in crime rate of over 12%. And in 2011 in Kentucky, the 1.6% reduction in Kentucky's prison population has been accompanied by a 17.1% reduction in its crime rate. And it's important to note that these data come from the actual departments of corrections in those states. And that brings me to the commission's work in Alaska. I applaud any justice reform effort that's bipartisan nature, and I give bonus points when the needs of crime victims are given the attention that they so rightfully deserve. And Alaska was, I think, very stellar in that. They included a great victim advocate, Brenda Santo, on the commission itself. And the commission's early and strong commitment to hearing the voices of victims in Alaska is where I came in. I began working in your state last summer looking at all the research that had been done relevant to victims' needs and victims' unmet needs, and realized there are still a lot of victims who remain unserved or underserved, including victims of child abuse and neglect, and the majority of Alaska women who experience at least one incident of intimate partner or sexual violence in their lifetime. And so my job was really to be, as I said, proactive in reaching out to survivors and advocates. We reached out to over 50 folks to really educate them about what the commission was trying to do and to invite them to join discussions to help us clarify victims' most important needs and concerns. And over a week in September, I had the opportunity to speak personally with several crime survivors. I finally got to meet Richard Sindinor in person. I had learned of their amazing work to pass Bleed Law from 5,000 miles away, so meeting them was very, very special to me. And I heard from a lot of domestic violence survivors for whom personal safety is really an oxymoron. And I talked to quite a few victim assistance professionals who just struggle to provide services to victims who so desperately need them in Alaska. Alaska is also unique. I keep saying that, but you all are. Instead of hosting one victim and advocate roundtable as we do in most states, we held two, one in Fairbanks, but one also in Bethel, where we threw in tribal elders and survivors to make sure that we were really able to understand the needs of victims in Alaska's bush communities. So overall, we had almost 30 survivors and advocates join these discussions. And it's important to know that their input, I think, has really informed the commission's work and the bill that you have before you today. And I believe you, someone has given you a paper copy of the summary report I wrote, so I would just encourage you to read the report and learn a little bit more about the 10 priorities that victims and advocates put forth. But I just want to wrap up by saying I believe that SB 91 offers a foundation and reinvestment funding that can not only make the roundtable's recommendation a reality, but also I think it really involves victims and provides them with rights to notification and input and safety and restitution across the criminal justice spectrum, which makes it, to me, and I do work in all 50 states, one of the most victim-centered pieces of legislation that I've seen over the past decade. And I have to end by saying I never seek to speak on behalf of victims and survivors because every single victim is unique and it's impossible to paint them with a broad brush. And my work, again, is really to make sure that their voices are heard and respected and reflected in public policy that affects their lives. I believe SB 91 accomplishes this, and I thank you and I thank the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission for simply validating the voices of victims and their advocates through this important bill and through the whole justice reform process. And if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them now.
Thank you, Ms. Seymour. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, Ms. Seymour, thank you for providing that invited testimony. Senator Kelly.
Just a quick question, Ms. Seymour. You spoke in support of 91. The changes that were made might be a little different than the commission's report. Essentially, did you have the same support for the commission?
I do. At this point, I do. And I also want to say I do appreciate that both on the House side and on this side, that you continue to listen to the voices of victims and advocates. That's very important as part of this process. I much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Seymour. And we appreciate you calling in and timing your plane so that you could have
I'm
an
off
opportunity
to
testify.
Now.
Have a good evening. I did pass out the written testimony. It's already included in your packet, but I wanted to raise it to your attention. The next person that has invited testimony is from OVR, the Office of Victims' Rights, Acting Director Catherine Hansen. Catherine, are you there?
Carrie McKinney, yes, I'm here. Can you hear me all right?
We can. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. Member of this committee, I am the Acting Director of the Office of Victims' Rights. I've worked at the Office of Victims' Rights since January of 2004. I've worked with every director at the Office of Victims' Rights since Steve Brunschweiler, who is the original director here at the Office of Victims' Rights. Through the years, I've had the opportunity to work with thousands of crime victims in Alaska, all throughout the state. Most of the victims that I work with are victims of homicide, sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor,
Catherine,
some property crimes, and some other types of crimes.
Catherine, can you pause? Okay. Can you pause for a second? Are you on speakerphone?
Yes, can I pick it up?
You need to. We can't hear what you're saying.
Okay, should I repeat?
You don't need to repeat, but you were muffled before. So can you give me like a 1 minute and then check back in with me so I can see if we've got the audio taken care of?
Okay. I think it's important for the committee as they consider this important bill, SB 91, to keep the Alaska Constitution in perspective. In particular, in 1994, the Constitution was amended to provide specific rights to crime victims. And those were overwhelmingly approved by voters, the citizens of the state of Alaska. And in 1994, to Article 1, Section 12, the section that governs criminal administration, a section was added that reads, criminal administration shall be based upon the following: the need for protecting the public, community condemnation of the offender, the rights of crime victims, restitution from the offender, and the principles of reformation. So now by law and by popular mandate from the citizens of Alaska, we have five areas to consider when we're making policy decisions about criminal administration for the people of Alaska. My concern is that SB 91 spends a lot of time focusing on offender rehabilitation, and that is an important goal, but it is one of five goals, and one goal is not more important than the other. If you can picture it as a table with five legs, all legs are required to hold the table up, and we can't just have a table with one leg. And I don't want to see the legislature make decisions that would be helpful for offender rehabilitation, reduce recidivism somewhat, but that would be at the expense of other crime victims or at the expense of the criminal justice system generally. I'm also concerned that we're not into a false dilemma that we have no choice. We have to let prisoners free, or we have to live with the current broken system, and you can only choose A or B. There are ways we could address offender rehabilitation by still protecting the public and not making choices where it's we're going to have one or we're going to have the other. An example to drive us home is the heroin problem we're having in Alaska. So I read an article in the Alaska Dispatch recently that said that there were a lot more children in OCS custody because their parents were having problems with opioid addiction and heroin addiction. Now imagine if we proposed a solution where instead of taking so many kids into OCS custody because it was too expensive, we decided not to take them into custody, save the money that we would have spent by taking those kids into custody, and using those money and reinvesting them into resources to help their parents not continue to be addicts. And we were projecting that our success rate would be 20%. That would be unacceptable because there would be children who would suffer. Now that's an extreme example, but crime victims, and that's the perspective I'm talking from, that's how they feel. And we have to remember that voice as we're making these important policy decisions. So I've given some detailed written testimony that comprehensively addresses OVR's concerns after looking at the ball and working with the bus sponsor. And one of the sections we address is having a concern about changing the prison to penalties for drug offenders. We're especially concerned that there shouldn't be lower penalties for offenders who would be dealing heroin or manufacturing drugs like methamphetamine. And an example I want to give the committee is something that's come up in the paper of a new crime this week, March 30th. There was a boat that was stolen and driven to Saldatna, and while the police were investigating the crime, they got a search warrant and did a large drug bust and found drugs, cash, weapons. Included in the drugs were methamphetamine, marijuana, and 150 grams of black tar heroin, worth an estimated $75,000 on the street. And what I wanted to present to the committee is that before SB 91, under current law, if we looked just at the heroin and not all the crimes committed here, and assume they were true, the drug possession would be an A felony crime with a presumptive term of 5 to 8 years. Assuming the first offender got a 6-year jail sentence, they'd be eligible for discretionary parole after serving a third of their time, or 2 years. And with good time and mandatory parole, would be added in 4 years. But once SB 91 is enacted, the same scenario would now be a B felony. The presumptive jail term would be 0 to 2 years. And even if the judge sentenced the offender to the maximum 2 years to serve, they would be, as a B felon, eligible for discretionary parole after serving 25% of their time, and so they would be released after 6 months. So we have to decide whether we really want to be punishing drug dealers less under the guise of rehabilitation. Another example, another thing that I wrote about in my written testimony is that we have opposition to reducing the current preemptive penalties for A, B, and C felons. Now, these presumptive felony terms would be lowered by an average of 2 years per sentence. And I want to give you another example. Also from this week's newspaper, Alaska Dispatch, on March 30th, there was a man who went to a random homeowner's door, pretended to be delivering a package, and when the homeowner answered the door, the suspect shot the homeowner in the torso and shot and killed his dog. The homeowner lived at this point, and if the suspect were found, he would be charged with assault in the first degree, an A felony. Under current law, the presumptive term would be 7 to 11 years in jail, assuming he got a 9-year sentence. After discretionary parole, it would be a release at 3 years, and mandatory release at 6 years. But under SB 91, we would be reducing those penalties by 2 years. The point I'm trying to make is that the goal of rehabilitation is important, and we definitely should be focusing on that, but there are cases where, despite our best intentions, people won't be rehabilitated, and isolation might be the goal. And we shouldn't lose sight of that possibility, and also we should always keep that safety net there in case it's necessary to protect the public. Another concern that OVR has is that under, again, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 24, specific guarantees to crime victims, and one is that the victim has the right to be heard at any proceeding during the criminal justice process. It could be bail, it could be sentencing, it could be probation violations, it could be parole. At any proceeding where a tribunal is considering the release of the defendant. And some of the sections in this bill take judicial discretion away from the judge deciding whether the person should be released, or the parole board deciding whether the person should be released, and setting caps, hard caps, or mandatory or release. And that's a violation of the Constitution. If the victim can't be heard, if they have something meaningful to say and the judge can't do anything about it, there should be a safety net there for those people.
Ms. Hansen?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Ms. Hansen, we only allotted 5 minutes, and I apologize. I have passed out and distributed your document dated March 30th with all the individual sections and your specific comments. It was my hope today that you would give an overarching reason for the concern with the bill before us, and that we would work through the individual sections through the written document that you've provided us. We have folks waiting online to testify. I'm sorry to try to limit your testimony right now. We certainly can have you back before the committee, possibly tomorrow, but we do have your written documents. Is there anything in closing? I just wanted to open the public hearing by 1:30.
Thank you for your time. A final comment. In the Senate Judiciary, there was a proposed amendment that did not pass through. I have not heard whether it's being revived, but it was an amendment that would reduce crimes of sexual abuse committed by offenders based on their age. If they were 16, 17, 18, or 19, it would be an affirmative defense because of their age to the crime, and I just wanted to let the community know if that amendment was being considered, that wasn't something OVR would be supporting. And I'm happy to talk to answer questions, talk to individual senators, and be of any help if needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. I'm not in receipt of that, but I've heard rumor, I believe, of what you were referring to. And there is opposition to that amendment if one reaches my table also. But if that does, you are welcome to provide additional comment and feedback. Are there questions from the committee for Ms. Hansen? Ms. Hansen, again, I've passed out and redistributed the March 30th, 2016 document, so I have that in my hands to discuss with my team.
Thank you. Should I hang up?
You're welcome to stay online and listen. I'm getting ready to open the public testimony.
Thank you.
With that, is there anything else to come before the committee before we begin public testimony? Public testimony is limited to 2 minutes. I know that this is a huge bill. The committee would like to hear high-level conversations. If you have detailed analysis of this bill, please send us an email. If you have written comments, we are happy to include it in consideration. With that, I'd like to start in the Mat-Su LIO, Janet Kincaid. Janet, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. Greetings. It's interesting to sit and watch you in action. I particularly wanted to address the reform that's being done on the driver's license. It's page 55. Um, I I think that this is certainly a step in the right direction. A person without a driver's license forever pretty much limits your ability to work, to support your family, to do all the things that need to be done. I've heard talk about we want to get people back with our budget crisis into tax-paying jobs as fast as we can. I realize not everybody will be rehabilitated, but those who have struggled and have gained a hand on their abuse, whether it be alcohol or drugs or whatever, it's nice if there can be some hope held out that there can soon be a better way and that they can continue then to go on and keep their families intact and provide for them. We live in rural areas primarily with no bus system, so a lack of driver's license really prohibits your ability to work and do things. And I thank you very much for considering this. I think it's exciting to see that we are looking forward and helping clear some of our prisons rather than build more. Thanks.
Ms. Kincaid, thank you for joining Senate Finance, and thank you so much for referring to a page number. The bill is big, and so it's nice to have specific comments on an area that I understand all people cannot do that, so please stay online, and it's certainly not mandatory. Clinton Cerda? Clinton, are you there?
I am.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. I would like to start out by saying I am an individual that has found themselves in this situation without a license to drive, and it was due to a felony DUI that I received in September of 2009. And I have been currently without a license since that time. And there is only a couple options for me. I do not drive, or I drive without a license. And I would like to obey the laws. I've learned the hard way, unfortunately. And addressing what's going on in this bill, I thank you for doing this. But I would like to have some sight on the fact that it doesn't reflect, the new language in the bill doesn't reflect what has happened in the past. It only reflects from the present to the future. And I would like an opportunity, I would like hope to be able to get a job, you know, that pays well. Before my DUI, I was a cell phone technician, and it required me going from cell site to cell site and maintaining these cell sites, and I cannot no longer do that. And so it has limited my job opportunities severely. And I would also like to just be able to pay taxes and be a contributing member to society, and there are implications and things that can be done to ensure the public safety. So I thank you, all of you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cerda, for joining Senate Finance today. Are there questions from committee members? The next person in the MATSU LIO, Marty Kincaid. Marty, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for your courage to address a paradigm shift that people are inherently good and redeemable. And specifically, I'd like to address the pages 50 and 55 regarding license, revocation, and reinstatement. And as previous testimony, the bill currently is only addressing present and future offenders, but I would like to make emphasis on past, as we heard from the gentleman that has lost his license for life after five DUIs a couple days ago. There is no hope for these families. And I've tried to find the statistics so that you guys would have some numbers to crunch on the cost savings or the cost to the state that are currently hidden when the family provider is in jail or has lost his job that has provided their or in their driver's license. And so what happens to these families and their children? They become on public assistance. They are at extreme risk for homelessness and poverty. So it is important to take measures for treatment while maintaining public safety to give hope to these individuals by restoration of their driver's license. And so my suggestions is, one, give opportunity for the past offenders, especially since treatment programs were unavailable at the time when many of them were sentenced. And two, drop the Class C felony for DUIs when there has been no harm to person or property. that would also open up many doors for opportunity to work. And I just thank you for the courage again to address these issues. And are there any questions?
Thank you, Marty. Mr. Schilling, could you approach the microphone? Mr. Schilling, quick question. We've had three speakers speak to driver's license. I have many more online. I don't know whether they want to talk about driver's license or not, but can you tell the committee if it's accurate that the current version of the bill represents a path forward for only future and present folks in the system that would lose their system in the future, or does it give an opportunity for those that have been convicted and are without driver's license into the future? Does the bill, Mr. Schilling, if you could give me some feedback.
Yep, thanks, Madam Chair. For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. The provision relating to limited licenses is retroactive. That's not to say that there aren't some technical changes that need to happen, but that's not one of them.
Thank you, Mr. Schilling. Questions from committee members? Senator Bishop. Okay, I just saw a thumbs up. Thank you. So for those who testified from the Matsu LIO, I just wanted to let you know and confirm for those listening that there is a path forward currently in the bill. You'll need to continue to follow it. As of this point in time, I have no amendments that are circulating that I know about today that would affect that particular change in the bill. So just wanted to let those online know that. Next, I'll take three off-net individuals, and then I'll move to another LIO. The first person signed up off-net is Tony Piper. Tony, are you only there for questions, or did you want to speak to us?
Madam Chair, I'm only here for questions.
Thank you. Next off-net, Ronald Michael Allen, Jr. out of Fairbanks. Mr. Allen, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you very much and good afternoon. I am here to talk about, I guess, page 50 and 55. I am at work, so I don't have the bill in front of me. I am a three-time DUI felon, and I just wanted to say I strongly support this bill because this is the first year I actually had to bike to work, walk to work, catch a cab to work, anywhere I can get to work. It is not fun trying to do this. My first couple DUIs, it was kind of like, I'm not saying it was a slap on the wrist, but you kind of get your stuff, your license back and everything, and then you just kind of go right back into it. I am a member of the Fairbanks Wellness Corps right now, and it has opened my eyes to so much stuff that I wish I would have known earlier in life that I think maybe, like on your second DUI, if somebody gets that, God forbid, that they do a program like this so they see and it opens their eyes earlier that you don't want to go down the felony road just for a DUI or something like that. And that's pretty much all I wanted to say, and thanks for listening to me.
Mr. Allen, thank you for calling in and participating. Any questions?
All right.
The next person off net is Casey St. Rose, followed by Kara Durr. Casey, welcome to Senate Finance.
Hi, thank you. I'm actually calling in representing Fairbanks Reentry Coalition. Several of us are encouraged to call and support. So I hope I hear some other folks too. Really, I just wanted to talk about how, as a community provider, Senate Bill 91, the hope that it gives us that there will be more opportunities for programming and treatment rather than just incarcerating folks and just locking them up, which then enables them to become better criminals. If there's not the rehabilitation process and there's not any funding available for services when these folks get out, there's little hope that they're going to make different choices. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the state of Fairbanks and the services that are available here. And we just completed a community survey through funding from the Mental Health Trust, and we are lacking services in Fairbanks. And if we don't do something different than we're doing right now, and we continue to incarcerate people at the rate that we are incarcerating people and not provide them treatment, not provide them programming, we're not going to see anything different, then we are going to have to build another facility, multi-million dollar facility. And I think that's all I have.
Casey, thank you for joining Senate Finance today. Next person in Anchorage, off-net, Kara Durr. Kara, are you there?
Yeah. Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kara Durr, and I am with the Food Bank of Alaska, and I wanted to share a few opinions on some provisions in Senate Bill 91. So this bill puts forth a lot of really good recommendations for reducing recidivism and saving the state money. One provision that we and our partners in the anti-hunger community have been really supportive of is a provision that repeals the lifetime ban on formerly convicted drug felons from receiving SNAP, which is Section 148, and it's on page 94. We're really happy to see this move forward. We're only one of six states that still have this ineffective ban in place. While we strongly support this provision, we are very concerned with Section 147, which is page 93 and 94, which is a new addition requiring mandatory drug testing for folks with previous drug felony charges who receive not only SNAP, but most public benefits. In order for convicted drug felons to receive SNAP, they have to be compliant with their parole as outlined in Section 148, which often includes the completion of a drug treatment program and drug testing. Putting the mandatory drug testing under the Department of Health and Social Services would be in many cases redundant and should be left to the Department of Corrections. DHSS currently faces a tremendous workload and they're already operating at reduced staffing and funding levels. This provision is going to increase the administrative burden they're facing, adding more work to their plates, requiring a new position to be created, and is going to require additional funding. Many other states have done similar provisions for drug testing SNAP recipients, and they've been shown to be really costly with little return on investment. And according to the fiscal notes here, this is going to be the case in Alaska with the program costing more than it saves. It'll be a net cost of about $83,500. We really can't afford during this fiscal climate to have these additional costs, especially for something that is probably going to have little return on investment and really won't help meet the overall goals of Senate Bill 91. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the Senate Finance Committee for hearing my testimony.
Thank you. The next person online is Nikki Hines, followed by Butch Moore.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Nikki Hines, and I'm the Prisoner Reentry Coalition Coordinator for the City of Fairbanks. In my position, I have the unique opportunity to visit those currently incarcerated. And a recent study done in the correctional facility this past week with the inmates has revealed that 100% of those that took the survey said that if job training was available prior to release, they would participate. 100% is a very strong number. They want an opportunity to succeed, and they want job training, and these are some of the essentials that will provide them with an opportunity once they are released. Senate Bill 91 will give them that opportunity for supportive services once they are released. And from that same survey that was done last week, more than 95% of them said the things that prohibit them from succeeding once they are released from jail are drugs, housing, and then the end jobs. 95% had stated those same three things. So if we're able to provide substance abuse counseling, employment training, and a safe place to live, I strongly believe that we'd be able to reduce recidivism rates. And I'd be glad to share those survey results with the members. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. Next person online is Butch Moore, followed by Reese Burke. Butch, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Butch Moore, and I'm speaking for myself and my wife, Cindy Moore. We are Bree Moore's parents. I would first like to thank everybody on your committee for voting yes to enact Alaska Safe Children's Act, Bree's Law, and Aaron's Law, and all the work everyone's done on it. I sent an email to you, and I'd like to address three items specifically in Senate Bill 91. And if you'll afford me a little bit extra time, I'll speak for Cindy as well, but I'll try and do it in 2 minutes if I can. One of the items that we asked, and we've worked very closely with Senator Coghill's office in Jordan, and they've been very accommodating in making a lot of amendments. The minimum mandatory sentence for rape with a weapon is 25 to 35 years. The minimum mandatory sentence for murder is 10 to 20 years. So the first item that I've asked for is to increase the current minimum mandatory sentencing of 15 years. Right now, murder one is 20 years. We would increase that to 35, which would be equal to that of rape with a weapon. And also 10 years for murder two. If we increased it 15 years, that would be 25, which is in line with the minimum mandatory for rape. Mr. Schilling did some research and found that the sentencing for murder is 47 to 57 years on average. So I don't believe that there would be a fiscal note if we increased it above the amendment, which is the amendment made March 23rd, Amendment 1.7, which adds 5 years. We could actually add a total of 15, which would even it up to what rape would be. The other item that we had discussed, and I'm not sure if this is in the latest draft, I wasn't able to download version S. When Josh Almeida killed my daughter Bree, the night before, that night, he walked into a liquor store with his license and bought alcohol. We need to add to the licensing section that when a person is on an alcohol-restricted parole or probation and their license is taken away, that when it is given back, they must get one with the red bars on it that says alcohol-restricted. Josh Almeida was on probation, but they handed his license back to him. It did not have the red bars on it. This would not be a cost to the state. Any offender that's on parole or probation with an alcohol restriction would have to pay for their license, and we could do this at pretrial when they're released. Or we could take their license away, give them a state ID, and they would have to go pay for a new license with the red bars. This potentially would have prevented the death of my daughter. The biggest savings that Senate Bill 91 can see is already included in one section that you've added 120 days of pretrial, and that was an amendment on 322.1.7, and I had misunderstood what that amendment was, and what my thinking is, and this has happened in the case of Josh Almeida, he was not ready to reach trial until 14 months after the crime. What the current law says, and I've included it in my email, is that at arraignment, there will be a trial that they set within 120 days, and if that is postponed, there will be a date certain set after that. It's now close to 2 years, and what's happened is that the defense attorneys are using this as a tool to get their clients off. The longer they can keep them in pretrial, the better the chances are they'll beat the charges, and people will forget, and witnesses will go away. And in a lot of cases, we have people awaiting trial or awaiting sentencing that are 4, 5, and 6 years long. We already know from the information that we have from our state that over the last 10 years, our prison population has increased 27%. 93% of that increase is in pretrial. And that is where we can affect the most cost. If we put a limit to where the prisoners, accused and the defendants are sitting in jail after 120 days, they do not receive any credit for that time towards their prison sentence. So they will be pushing their defense attorneys not to extend, but they'll be pushing either to make a plea deal or to get into trial. That'll take all the pressure off of pretrial, which is where the overcrowding is happening right now. That's what's happening with Josh Almeida and many other prisoners. The other thing that we can do in addition to that is charge the defendants for the time that they're there for room and board. I've checked this with several state agencies and different people, and there is not anything that is unconstitutional about this. Yes, I would encourage you to do some research on that, and I can provide some other information, but I think that Senate Bill 91 with a couple of changes can be very beneficial to a lot of us.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. And I did let you go 5 minutes. I wanted to let you know also that Senate Judiciary changed and added 5 years for murder already, so now in the current bill it is 25 years for murder one and 15 years for murder two. Thank you so much for calling in today and testifying. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, the next person online to testify is Reese Burke.
Hello?
Mr. Burke?
Yes, this is Reese Burke, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Welcome to Senate Finance, sir.
Thank you. As far as the financial side goes, I've read that it'll save the state of Alaska $400 million over 10 years. Also, there's a 100, and this is on the driver's license, there's a $125 fee, I believe, to reinstate the license. That will go directly back into the state funds. Back into the local economy, there will be the installation and maintenance of an interlock device, $195 to $125 for installation, $90 to $125 a month for the cost of maintaining the interlock device for the 36 months. There will also be things like fuel, tires, auto repair. My vehicle set since 2012. I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of leaks. My vehicles I'm going to be talking to and working with mechanics. I work in electrical construction trade and have not been able to find employment due to the fact that I do not have a valid Alaska driver's license. I would like to become a participating, functional, profitable person in my own community. And it's extremely hard to do when you can't find work. As of today, I am 1,419 days sober. And I attribute that to the 18-month treatment program through the Wellness Court and Pacific Rim Counseling. I'm hoping that the Senate will pass Senate Bill 91, and they will pass, and the House will pass Senate Bill 205, and let us become members of our society again instead of winding up under the Christmas tree bridge or in a welfare house or on welfare itself. I don't want to take food stamps. My wife's working two jobs. I'm unable to work. Please help us. Thank you.
Mr. Burke, thank you for sharing your story and testifying before Senate Finance today. Congratulations on your sobriety. One more person off net, then I'm going to move up to the Barrow LIO. Edward Smag. Edward, are you online?
Yes. Hi, my name is Edward Smaggy. I'm calling from Fairbanks, Alaska.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Hi. I'm also a Fairbanks Wellness Court graduate. I have about just over 2 years sobriety. And I've listened to a lot of people talk about recidivism, you know, the possibilities of getting their license back. And, you know, it's a struggle for sure without it. But when someone, you know, they continue to make their goals and progress forward, and it builds on them, and it builds in the community, and the community sees that, you know, this person's doing really well. And the gentleman that spoke before said, you know, he is struggling, and it's hard to find jobs and without a driver's license. I would like to see it, you know, to where if somebody did complete, you know, the extensive treatment that I've gone through and that a lot of other people have gone through, that there is a possibility to have a driver's license reinstated with an interlock device. You know, I would be willing to pay for an interlock device for the rest of my life. You know, that's how important it is to me and my family. I just wanted to voice that and say thank you. I'm really nervous right now. I'm sitting here at Safeway on Airport, and it's amazing where you could just see people that are, you know, going about their daily lives and driving. And a lot of us that have made those mistakes, we miss that opportunity, and, you know, we feel it. We made the mistake, and we just want to move on, you know, and if it costs the state a lot of money to, you know, have a direction of, you know, incarcerating people for misdemeanors and then, you know, the felony DUI, and it becomes a revolving door for sure. And I've been in it for a long time, and I wish I'd, you know, really opened up my eyes a long time ago and said, enough is enough. I have a family, and they're the most important thing to me in the world right now. But how can I provide better for them is going to work. And I do have a job. Promotions and being able to travel out of town, I can't. I'm limited. So it would be great to see the bill, you know, with driver's license change. And thank you to the Fairbanks Wellness Court, my probation officer, my old probation officer, Monty Ford, and everybody that's involved in it. You know, it's what Fairbanks needs. It's what Alaska needs. And I think that the bill that we're talking about would give an incentive for people to make that change and stay with it. You know, give us a goal, you know, a light at the end of a little bit of tunnel, you know. But thank you.
Edward, thank you for sharing your story and testifying before Senate Finance, and congratulations on your sobriety.
Thank you.
Heading to the Barrow LIO, Michael Jeffrey. Michael, are you there?
Yes, good afternoon, Senator McKinnon and Senator Kelly and the other members of the committee. My name is Michael R. Jeffrey. I've lived in Barrow for over 39 years, first as a legal services attorney, not involved in the criminal justice system, and then as a superior court judge for over 32 years until my retirement in December of 2014. Of course, as a superior court judge, you're involved with criminal justice issues every day. I'm also a member of two statewide committees on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. But I'm representing myself today, and I just really honor the effort that went into this SB 91 to bring evidence-based practices to the Alaska justice system and adopting recommendations from the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, which had the 3 years of deliberations and a great cross-section of people involved in reaching these decisions. The parts of it that I just like to highlight, the part of it where there's an assessment of prisoners coming when they're coming into the justice, the correction system, to see what their needs are, addictions, maybe FASD, and have better work with them while they're in corrections. Another is to the bail changes to make it based on a person's risk rather than whether they can post money. Another one is reinvesting, of course, savings back into community services and not just turning them into kind of into the general fund, but to provide the services that are needed for returning citizens to readjust to the community and hopefully greatly reduce our recidivism rate. And so I just thank the committee for taking time with this and among all the many issues that you're dealing with, and that would close my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Jeffrey. We appreciate you calling in today. Thank you for your service to the state. With that, I'd like to come to Juneau, and we'll take four folks in Juneau, and then we'll go back to OffNet. Graham Smith. Graham, are you here in Juneau? And if I could cue up Sarah Khalifi, if you could just be ready to take the microphone.
Hi, I'm Graham Smith from CMAX, and I'm here to make a recommendation on the community supervision recommendations. There seems to be some wonderful ideas coming forward in establishing pretrial services in the state of Alaska. And I would strongly recommend that the state consider using existing providers and services that are already available in the communities, specifically the electronic monitoring services that are existing in the communities. Right now, it appears that DOC will expand their electronic monitoring into the pretrial services. And I don't really believe that that's important and necessary when there's a private industry that is involved in currently providing those services. The private industry is more flexible. It'll be cheaper than having another layer of employees in the state of Alaska providing that service. The service would basically be providing identical results, evidence-based documentation to ensure that people are remaining compliant with their court orders and their conditions of their release. And I believe that private electronic monitoring services are actually more flexible than DOC getting into that area. For example, we do a lot of monitoring in custody cases. I have private attorneys that recommend the families when there's questions about alcohol or location monitoring. We have attorneys recommending the services, and I believe that the flexibility we have, for example, not too long ago, the attorneys were concerned about an issue with somebody using a computer and phone calls and their telephone to harass and get involved in that the other party's affairs. So we put into place a system where we can monitor their phone and their computers. You know, we were able to do that immediately. Our flexibility allowed us to immediately provide a notification service monitoring their phones and their computer services. So therefore, in summary, I'd like to highly recommend that the committee consider using the services that are currently available in the communities. I believe that the results will be identical.
Graham, I just wanted to let you know that I just received notification that during the Senate Judiciary hearing that they amended that particular language and they can contract out pretrial electronic monitoring now.
Correct. And I read that language, and I appreciate that. But it almost looks like an add-on, as if the service isn't available in Angoon, they'll find a way to get a private organization to maybe go over there and provide the service.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, the next person here in Juneau, Sarah, I'm sure I'm not getting your last name right. Fly-fi?
Sarah Cleafy.
Cleafy, thank you.
It happens a lot. Thank you, Chairwoman McKinnon, and to the Senate Finance Committee for hearing my testimony today. Again, my name is Sarah Cleafy, and I work with the Alaska Food Coalition based out of Anchorage. And I represent about 125 organizations around the state who work with Alaska's most vulnerable people in both rural and urban communities. And I just want to say I believe this bill provides concrete steps to improve efficiency in our criminal justice system, save money, and most importantly, enables access to food for formerly incarcerated nonviolent drug felons. However, I do want to voice my concern for the addition of Section 147 on page 93 that requires mandatory drug testing for not only food stamp or SNAP recipients, but for all public assistance programs for former drug felons. As Ms. Durr stated in her testimony earlier, we have data from other states like Arizona, Missouri, and Florida who have all implemented drug testing for public assistance programs, and they've proven extremely costly and again have a very low return rate on folks who are actually utilizing drugs in those instances. And so, you know, based on the attached fiscal notes to the bill, we realize that in Alaska it would be extremely costly as well, with an estimated $247,100 to implement this statewide drug testing operation. And additionally, in Section 148 on page 94, it's already stated that former drug felons must be compliant with the terms of their probation and parole in order to receive food stamps, and additionally mandatory participation in rehabilitation programs. So we believe that Section 147 is a costly redundancy, and they estimate $163,600 in savings, but that is only if each former drug felon tested is found indeed to be using. So, you know, it's just a potential cost savings. You know, we believe that this drug testing provision would be punitive for not only formerly incarcerated individuals, but for Alaskan families from receiving child care benefits, general heating assistance, and other crucial resources for folks to rebuild their lives after they've served their time. And just to wrap it up, an argument was made that, you know, this provision is included as a public safety measure, but we, in fact, think it increases public safety concerns because these resources really help people get back on their feet, and without them, you know, they could be back on the streets or back in the revolving door to the prison system in our state. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention, and thank you so much to the committee and Chairwoman McKinnon. And yeah, that's all.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Madam Chair, with your permission, would it be possible if we could get a copy of her written, or if I could, I'd like to have a copy of her comments.
Sarah, if you, sure,
if you have written comments and you could send them to our secretary, we can distribute them and have them part of the...
Sure, yeah. Would you like to copy it? Yeah.
Senator Michiki.
It's very messy, I apologize.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Michiki.
Sarah, just a question for you. Part of the effectiveness of the bill is some expectations of personal responsibility and performance, and in exchange for that, there's some lesser time that's spent inside, and I understand that not everyone has an equal opportunity to succeed, but it seems like we've heard from a couple of the food banks. What is the connection there in your interest? Is it just food security for families in need, or do you have any other reason to be concerned on what I see as an expectation for, we want to see a better result. We want to see some personal responsibility and better performance once they leave.
Absolutely. Senator Michiki, I think that, you know, it's our concerns as food banks is that, you know, if we have clients that don't have to be using our services and accessing emergency food, we don't want them to be. We want them to, you know, be self-sufficient. We want them to be productive and contributing members to society. We want them to, you know, get back on their own feet. So the reason we really support this provision in the bill, or Section 148, which removes the lifetime ban for former drug felons, is so that way they can. They can buy their own groceries. They can, you know, not need to come to us because we would like to save that for, you know, folks that, you know, we don't want it to be a chronic use of emergency food. We want them to, again, contribute to society. So I think that, that's one reason we've all kind of unified on this provision. And then with Section 147, we think that it's just a, it's more the cost that we are seeing that, you know, we already know that the Division of Public Assistance has an extremely high backlog for SNAP or food stamp recipients. So we think that adding this to the burden of the Division of Public Assistance versus leaving up to corrections to, you know, administer drug testing for these folks, we don't think that they shouldn't be held accountable by continuing drug testing after their release. We just don't think that that should be administered by the Division of Public Assistance or affect their ability to receive food. So, that's...
Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah.
Senator Kelly, did you have a comment question? Thank you. Next person here in Juneau to testify, Karen Nelson, followed by Derica Clark, and then we'll move back off net.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Karen Nelson. I'm the director of Haven House, which is a recovery residence for women coming home after incarceration. I could speak on every section, but I'm going to speak on the reinvestment piece today. I am a formerly incarcerated woman as well as a person in long-term recovery, and I'm going to, I don't normally do this, but I'm going to read a piece that really articulates it very well. And I also am speaking for the hundreds of men and women who are incarcerated today in our state and their families that are directly affected. I'm a victim of sexual assault and domestic violence. I'm also an offender with two felony drug convictions. These two things are related. I support the Alaska Justice Reinvestment Initiative in Senate Bill 91 and House Bill 205. because our justice system is failing my peers who are victims and also failing my peers who are offenders. We can do better, and this reform package is the first big step in that direction. Like me, many Alaskans who land in our prisons have trauma in their past. These traumas may be from violence, neglect, loss, or chaos in homes and elsewhere. For many of us, they have raised our everyday stress levels to the point where we're almost always in flight or fight mode. We may have very short triggers or crushing depression, and left untreated, we cope with these traumas in our lives with alcohol, drugs, and sometimes more violence. This is not an excuse for causing harm to others, ourselves, or our communities. It's a call to action. Alaska spends hundreds of millions of dollars on prison beds each year, but next to nothing on treatment services for offenders and victims. Lawmakers should not be surprised when there is such a substantial overlap between those of us who are victims and those of us who are offenders. Nor should they be surprised that so many of us who leave prison return within a few years. Long-term success and stability in the community requires more than just harsh punishments. It requires housing, employment, and support for recovery. It requires sheltering, safety plan, and help with child care. These services are vital but are drastically underfunded. Criminal justice reforms are not just pro-offender or pro-victim. That's a false dichotomy. This rethinking of how we spend money will get much better outcomes for offenders and for victims, meaning improve public safety and also improve personal safety. We are your neighbors and family members. We want to contribute to our state. We want to contribute to our communities. We deserve a system that helps us on that journey. Thank you.
Kara, thank you for sharing your story and testifying before us today. Derica Clark. She's okay. In Juneau, is it Michelle Federico? We're sure Ms. Clark doesn't want to testify. Senator Michicki.
Madam Chair, Kara has left, but I wanted to congratulate her on being an amazing woman and turn her life around in the face of a whole bunch of adversity. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Michicki.
Hi, thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Michelle Federico, and I live in Juneau, Alaska. I'm here representing myself and Gastineau Human Services, where I'm employed as the Client Services Director. GHS is commonly known as the Halfway House, and it accepts up to 85 individuals in out-of-jail or community placements with an emphasis on providing structure, accountability, rehabilitation skills, case management, services to promote improved capacity and stability as people prepare to leave DOC custody. In addition to the Halfway House, we also provide transitional housing for up to 28 homeless men and women. And lastly, we're the community provider for outpatient substance abuse treatment services in Juneau, funded through Behavioral Health. Our clients are primarily from Southeast Region, but many are from all over the state of Alaska. GHS, we and myself personally support SB 91 because it appears that the intention of the bill is to target the right people with the right interventions at the right time, which I believe is critical to helping individuals develop and sustain motivation to change dysfunctional behavior. The bill will help clients we serve improve their functional ability and to be able to continue to access public resources and services to assist them during their transitional stages. SB 91 encourages DOC staff to build collaborative partnerships with non-DOC partners with the common goal of successful reintegration into community for offenders. As a master's level substance abuse counselor who is also a functional alcoholic and is now in recovery for 7 years, what I see from my clients and for myself is that once addicts and alcoholics address their substance use issues and correct negative behavior patterns, they are likely to function to the best of their ability over time, like any other citizen. Thank you.
Any questions from committee members? Michelle, thank you for joining Senate Finance today. Moving off net, the next person online to testify is Chris Nettles. Chris, are you there?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my thanks to the committee as well for this opportunity to testify. I'm a small business owner here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm testifying on behalf of my small business as well as an active member in the National Federation of Independent Businesses of the Alaska chapter. My concern particularly with Senate Bill 91 is the proposal to raise the threshold felony level for theft to $2,500. I've been involved in several testimonies regarding this all the way back to 2 years ago when they raised it from $500 to $750, and now we're talking about raising it from $750 to $2,500. I just want to say that I don't think that's going to work out very well for us business owners on the Main Street. Over the last 2 years, we've seen an increase in small crimes in our area here at near the intersection of Old Seward and Dowling, which is not a particularly bad crime area. In particular, not only has my business suffered theft of misdemeanor levels, but we do a lot of work in the field, in particular the Bush and the North Slope, and many of our crew members park their cars here at our offices and then go out into the field, and when they come back, they find their trucks have been broken into, numerous things stolen out of it, including paperwork, personal items, etc. It is becoming a nuisance at this particular co-location we're at now, and is actually, along with other forces, business forces, we are now looking at having to get our own piece of property as well as trying to build a fence to keep this kind of thing from happening. With the continued downward pressure from oil prices as well as the state budget problems, I don't see a rosy economic picture in the next year or two, and I'm also very concerned that we're going to see an increase in the kinds of crime levels, particularly property crime and larceny, that we've seen a little bit of an increase in, particularly on the lower level misdemeanor level thefts. So I wanted to testify as a concerned citizen and an owner that this is impacting our business. Business, because of the economic conditions we're having in the state as well, many of the bids that go out from either states or from the private concerns are getting very competitive. And with us continually having to replace items that are stolen or whatever, it puts a significant pressure on us to bid competitively. So I want the committee as well as the senators there to know that it is impacting business. And that's all I have to say, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance, Chris. Next, off-net, Marna Stanford. Sanford. Marna, are you there?
I am, thank you. I'm calling on behalf of the 10 Latifs Conference in Fairbanks. We're an Alaska Native organization that represents 42 member tribes. And personally, as a former public defender of 8 years, I have to tell you that this bill has been exciting to watch as it progresses. Been following it pretty closely. And I want to thank Senator Coghill's staff for being, I think, very receptive to the victims' rights advocates and working with them, although a lot of what I think Senate Bill 91 is focusing on is actually the nonviolent crimes. I think you would all agree. A few comments. I definitely second what Kara Durr from the Food Bank Alaska has to say with regards to Section 147. We would also encourage you to hold strong on the felony theft threshold and not change it lower than the $2,000 that is in the bill currently. One of our favorite sections is 146, which I actually did not write a page number down. I apologize. But that is extending the life of the Criminal Justice Commission to June 30th, 2021. We think they have a lot of additional work to do and believe that they can help address all of the concerns that remain with regards to this bill. Property owners, business owners, victims' rights advocates, a lot of the things that the Criminal Justice Commission has on their docket currently, if their sunset date isn't extended, are going to be addressing these things, according to Mary Geddes, who's, I think, their staff attorney. But this will give them additional time to look at so many things that will be benefit to Alaskans seeing the full benefits of SB 91. I do have one particular change that I would ask the Senate Finance Committee members to look at, and that's Section 61, page 35, on the suspended entry of judgment. That particular provision, specific to a very small class of people, this has to be pretty much your first offense. You can't have a prior felony. You can't have a prior any type of assault. And this gives you an opportunity to really have it's not the suspended imposition of sentence that we've seen before. This allows you to have a completely clean record. But within the suspended entry of judgment provision, it requires that you get the consent of the prosecution. And I would ask that you guys would look at that, because I think that not allowing a defendant to argue that in front of the judge without the permission or the consent of the prosecution might really further limit the amount of people who would be able to get the benefit of that suspended entry of judgment. Thank you. That concludes my comments.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford. Are there questions from committee members? Next person online is Christina Love. Christina, are you there?
I am. Thank you so much, members of the committee. please bear with me. I am at a conference in Anchorage, and I have my two-year-old here, so I'm just going to try and be as quick, as thorough as possible. So, again, my name is Christina Love. I'm a survivor of domestic violence, sexual assault, and trauma. I'm also formerly incarcerated in person and long-term recovery. Can you guys hear me okay?
We can.
Okay. So my mother is autistic, and my father is a convicted pedophile. In my early 20s, I was treated to alcohol and drugs to make all of my uncomfortable feelings disappear. In college, I experimented with drugs, and what I found was that I required more and more to keep my illusion of comfort and happiness alive. I thought that I was free from my pain and suffering. In the years followed, I tried to retreat. I tried to reach out for help, but I was met with a toxic torment and sense of hopelessness, humiliation, and despair about myself and my future. The implication that normal people don't use drugs on a daily basis meant that something was very wrong with me. I spent many endless days trying to fix myself. Hopeless and helpless, I began to retreat into a dark world of drugs and crime. As the years went by, my deterioration of self and psyche was traumatic. My disease was a catalyst for discrimination, verbal abuse, physical and sexual assault. I honestly felt that I would be better off dead. I was diagnosed and discarded. I was so tormented that I tried to kill myself. These are vital steps in part of my recovery. I needed encouragement to see that my experience, that my use was an experience and is a symptom of my disease. I needed hope to believe that recovery does work. I found people that empowered me to save myself and understand that my disease is a meaningful response to a traumatic life event, particularly my childhood trauma. My disease is not my enemy, but a source of insight to solve emotional problems. I don't have a drug problem. I have a life problem, not a moral dilemma, but a disease that can be treated and addressed properly. I am absolutely in support of Senate Bill 91, particularly the reinvestment piece and the offender rehabilitation. 1 in 100 citizens in the U.S. are confined in jail and prison. 80% of offenders use drugs and alcohol. 50% are clinically diagnosed. There was an article in the Anchorage Daily News that also talked about the staggering percentage of people that are incarcerated that have FASD. We have policies that are in place that are in conflict with our goals. Our goals of reducing recidivism, rehabilitation, and recovery. And I think that this bill really can transform the system. Instead of asking questions of why, we have a unique opportunity to change the language to how can we make this work. I feel that especially the section 148 on SNAP. When I learned that that me and other drug-related offenders didn't have the opportunity for food stamps, but my father did, as well as our time, that we were looking at more jail time for selling and using drugs than my father was for sexually assaulting me and my sisters. I think that these are huge, important pieces, and I don't think that we're asking for better, but more just to be on the same playing field. I think that wraps it up for me. Thank you so much.
Christina, thank you for testifying and sharing your story with Senate Finance today. The next person off net is Vicki Wallner. Vicki, are you there? Vicki, possibly you hit mute? Vicki, are you there? Hello, Vicki.
Hi.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Okay, sorry. I somehow or another did that. I don't know how I did. But I am Vicki Wallner. I am founder of Stop Valley Thieves in the Manuska Valley. Currently, we have about 11,000 members. I've been doing this since 2013. I have watched all the committee meetings. There are parts of this bill that I think are really good, and some of them being the removal of barriers to success after they're incarcerated, the DMV licensing, are really good things. However, so much of this bill, I believe, has swung the pendulum so far in favor of the offender that it's impossible to support the bill. So, and because the bill is so huge, it's hard to list concerns that support part of it and doesn't support the other part, especially when the part that I don't feel is in favor of the victim is so much of it. My concern is that research and information that's been provided in support of this bill has been focused on a preset goal or a preset outcome, and sometimes that skews the results to one side. As I've watched these hearings in all the committees, my concern is all presentations before the committee have been backing information and results of the commission. Little to no time has been allocated to opposition to the bill. And as I listen to them, the commission reports and presentations, they're so good, I want to jump on board. However, as I'm listening to them, facts and figures that they have presented immediately stood out to me and the other admins in our group as misrepresenting what we are seeing on the ground. Speakers that are in opposition, that are calling in on a public line, many times are cut short. Because of the large change to our criminal justice system this bill is going to make and the potential for unintended consequences, I believe it's imperative that these committees give some time to provide a more fair and balanced view of the possible consequences. I've put together a PowerPoint with facts and figures, which I believe will provide some additional light on the facts of this bill that have not been presented to the committee. If the committee would allow me some time to present that, I would be more than willing to fly to Juneau and present that PowerPoint and information regarding what our research has discovered.
Vicki, thank you for testifying in Senate Finance today. If you'd like to send the PowerPoint, we'd be happy to review it.
Okay. I just believe being there in person has a little different impact than on a piece of paper or on the phone.
Thank you. Again, please submit that PowerPoint. We'd love to take a review it. And I did tell the person that we allowed 5 minutes to from OVR that we would get back to them and review all the written documents.
Okay.
So we absolutely did not plan to cut them off. We had prearranged
sure.
5 minutes and allowed 10. But,
right.
Senator Machiki has a question for you, Vicki.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Wallner. We have a similar problem on the Kenai and a similar group to Stop Valley Thieves on the Kenai. Just conceptually, can you give us a couple of, don't want to give a lot of extra time, it's up to the chair, but conceptually in a minute or two, do you have a couple of areas you'd like to highlight?
I do. Actually, as the figures were being presented for cost savings and reinvestment and the cost to provide some of these programs, it seemed to me the savings portion seemed to be inflated. And also the savings portion included an $8 million cut that was already done to Department of Corrections that has nothing to do with this bill. It's going to happen regardless. And when we're looking at the cost of instituting it, I believe those costs are going to be higher than what was reported. And there'll be continuing costs after that that are not taken into account when we look at savings. The other thing is that as we looked at bail and pretrial, we were seeing a much different picture of what is happening currently in our jail system compared to the number of people that are admitted into the correction system every year. We're seeing people come right back out within 24 to 48 hours in the majority of cases. When they're talking about longer stays, that's not what we're seeing. Presumptive sentencing, we're seeing that those are people are coming back way quicker than what their sentence was supposed to be, even in second and third time offenders. So as we dug into the information, we found a fair amount of what we believe is discrepancies. And I don't think they were intentional. You know, I really don't. I think that everybody, we all want to solve this problem. It's just that I'm worried about going the full Monty and having unintended consequences as a result.
Senator Machicki?
Just one final question is, how do you feel about the property limits or crime limits being increased?
One thing that is not taken into account, and I really just discovered it this year, is that when they're looking at property crime, they look at the depreciated value of that property when they assess an value. They don't consider replacement cost. A prime example of that is if someone gets all their tools stolen. It is the depreciated value of those tools. It's not what that person is going to have to go out and pay to get those tools replaced. So all property is depreciated. So when you're talking about a $2,000 limit, that would make us one of the highest felony theft levels in the country. Put us in the top 2 or 3%. And I think that we need to look at more of a $1,000 limit that would be more in line with the rest of the country.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The next person waiting to testify off net, and then I'll return to Juno, is J.C. Robertson. J.C., are you there?
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
We can. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Hey, thanks for having me. So my name is Jace Robertson, and I am from Kenai, Alaska. And I'm calling to express my immense support for Senate Bill 91. I'm a rehabilitated felony DUI offender. Was convicted in 2011. I've been clean and sober almost 5 years, and you know I take full responsibility for my actions. However, I am continually held back by my felony conviction and inability to drive. The section that I support the most, I believe, is Section 82. So it's changed a couple times on me. I believe it's Section 82 regarding granting limited licenses to felony DUI offenders. So, you know, in a nutshell, I can't express how much I support criminal justice reform. I believe the Department of Corrections has this facade that they claim they focus on rehabilitation. Well, I've been incarcerated many times. My youthfulness behavior was, drug-related activity when I was younger, and it's a complete facade, in my opinion. So I also, support these reentry and, the money it costs to house an offender could be better used providing rehabilitative services. But primarily, I am in support of the section, which I believe is now Section 82, allowing a felony DUI offender to obtain a limited driver's license. So, and additionally, I also raised $1,400 to travel to Juneau. I was there back in March the 1st of March, and spoke with the legislators, and yeah, I appreciate how you guys work on the bill.
Jace, thank you for joining Senate Finance today and sharing your story. Congratulations on your sobriety.
Oh, thank you.
I apologize for your name. I have a cousin named JC.
That's no problem.
The next person here in Juneau is Veronica Parks. Veronica, if you join us at the microphone, state your name and any affiliation for the record.
Hi, my name is Veronica Parks. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I just wanted to speak a little bit about my experience in the court systems. I was convicted of two drug felonies in 2012, and I've been released a couple times, and those few times I was released, I had no resources or any way to transition back into the community in a different way than how I used to live. So I just got back out of prison and went back to my old behaviors. And last year, I've been sober since February 15th of 2015. And last year when I was incarcerated, the Reentry Coalition came in to the prison and helped me get into treatment. After I was released, I went up to treatment for 9 months, and that treatment center showed me a new way to live, showed me how to love myself and how to, you know, be a responsible adult. And it's changed my life. You know, I support the Senate Bill 91, and I would just like to see other people get the chance that I've been given, because if it can work for me, it can work for anyone. So, thank you.
Are there questions from committee members?
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story, Veronica, and attending Senate Finance today. Next person off net, Zachary Finkel. Zachary, are you there?
Yeah, hello?
Hello, welcome to Senate Finance.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm Colin. I'm also a felony DUI offender, and I'm currently in this program called Wellness Court. And when I heard about Senate Bill 91, I thought it was a great idea. I look at, like, all the DUI offenders that lose their driver's licenses for a lifetime, and they go out and, I mean, how many driving on suspended and more DUIs happen because they don't get their driver's licenses back? And I think after going through an extensive program like Wellness Court and gaining sobriety and having something like Senate Bill 91 with having the option of a life or a driver's license reinstated would be that much more of an incentive to stay sober, and I just think it's a really positive thing for the community and a good thing. So I definitely support this bill. And yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Zachary, thank you for joining Senate Finance today and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else off net or online in an LIO that's wishing to testify on Senate Bill 91, the Omnibus Crime Bill? Is there anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify on SB 91? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Members of the Finance Committee, is there anything else to come before the committee? I would ask you to review. There is extensive conversation on Senate Bill 91 that has come in today, both in verbal testimony and online. If there's others that are still listening, we are accepting public testimony or public correspondence on this bill. Amendments are due by 5 p.m. today to my office. It's my plan right now to bring those amendments before the committee tomorrow, and then try to put together a CS to lay on the table on Monday so that we can let it rest to see if there's any additional changes that need to be made to the bill. And the goal would be to move the bill no later than Wednesday to the Rules Committee. But, so that's the trajectory of what we are trying to attempt. But obviously, if there are significant changes that someone suggests from this building or at this table, we may be delayed on that timeline. But that's the intent of the chair at this moment with the information I've received. With that, the Senate Finance Committee will meet tomorrow, Saturday, April 2nd at 10 a.m. We'll have SB 91 before us and go through an amendment process. That has been noticed.
Is that an April Fool's joke?
It is not an April Fool's joke. I am sorry. Senator Hoffman, it is the real thing and has been noticed. I'd like to thank all our support that we have every day from the Senate Finance Team, gavel to gavel, over at the legislative office. We appreciate all your support and help, especially the extra service when we have people trying to call us and have clarity when they testify before us through the off-net sites. With that, this committee is adjourned.